Do we recognize this man's name? For more than 20 years, two decades, this fella has been making predictions about the stock market. He has made some major, I mean substantial predictions about the market, and the notable thing about him is he's often been wrong. Not 100% of the time, but often been wrong. Here are a few examples. Back in 1999, this obviously goes back more than 20 years, he predicted that the 2000s were going to roar. The Dow was going to be at 35,000. Here was the reality. The Dow peaked at 12,000 and the decade was a bust. 2021, he said that there was going to be a 45% crash by June. And then he doubled down on that with a minus 80% by Thanksgiving. The market hit new highs. 2023, he doubled down on a recession and another big wave down. Bitcoin rallied 200%. The S&P 500 was up 20%. Now, if somebody is making predictions over a period of 20 or 25 years, they're probably going to get it right sometimes. It reminds you of the weather forecaster a little bit. It's going to be sunny tomorrow. It's going to be rainy tomorrow. He's probably got a 50-50 chance of being right. He's going to get it right sometimes, but we know that they are often wrong. People have been making predictions for a long time. There have been religious predictions, for example, the coming of Christ. There have been climate predictions. I'm old enough to remember that back in the 70s, people were talking about the earth turning into a giant deep freeze. We're all going to die because it was so cold. And then it turned into global warming, and now it's just climate change. Pollution. People have been making claims about pollution, even noise pollution. Noise pollution would wipe us out, and that was supposed to have happened several years ago. People have been making predictions about population. Predictions have been made about crude oil. Predictions have been made about animals and robots, all kinds of predictions. So men make predictions. Men are often wrong when they make predictions. And that causes us, or should cause us, to think about God. Does God make predictions? That would be one great question to ask. And number two, if God does make predictions, how accurate is he? How often is he correct? The Bible answers that. And it answers it in places like Isaiah chapter 48 and verse 5. God says, "Even from the beginning, I have declared it unto you. Before it came to pass, I proclaimed it to you, lest you should say, my idol has done them." God says, I have declared information before it came to pass. Before this event ever came up, before somebody ever began to think about it or talk about it, God says, I told you that it was going to happen because I have foreknowledge. Now, sometimes this may happen with a national event like an election. People will say, well, I knew it was going to go that way. I knew they were going to win the game. I knew that they were going to lose. I knew that tomorrow was going to be rainy. I knew that tomorrow was going to be cloudy. And after the fact, when someone makes that statement, I knew it was going to be this or that. Okay, you know, you might be right, and you might be telling me the truth. Maybe you're lying, but it's certainly possible that you did predict that, at least to yourself, before that took place. But that's not all that impressive, really, telling someone after the fact that they knew that something was going to occur. God says, I can predict. And not only can I can predict from any point what's going to happen, and I'm going to be right every single time. A few chapters before Isaiah chapter 48 and verse 5, we have this. Isaiah chapter 44 and verse 7, God says, and who can proclaim, who can predict as I do? That's a great question. The answer to that question is implied. God says, there is nobody in the universe who can predict like me. I know everything that's going to happen before it occurs. God can predict the future, and there is simply no way that we can illustrate that, at least perfectly. This passage implies that angels have limited knowledge of the future. Even the good angels have limited knowledge of the future. Let's skip to the New Testament for just a second. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 12. Here Peter said, which things angels desire to look into. The angels would not have wanted to look into things. They would not have any desire to look into things if they were able to perfectly predict the future or have full knowledge of the future. Before Jesus came into the world, angels were interested in knowing what the future was going to involve. This morning, if you were here, and most of us were, we looked at some information relative to the occult. There are some people today, a fair number of people, they want to gain access to future knowledge. They perhaps are looking for financial information. They're looking for other, perhaps, facts about the future. But God says, it's only me. Only I have knowledge of the future. And God has used that knowledge to predict some things. Oftentimes, God has worked through men known as prophets. In Luke chapter 1 and verse 70, the Bible says, and he spoke by the mouth of his holy prophets, who have been since the world began. Prophets were spokesmen for God. Sometimes, as you look at the role of a prophet was really a preacher. He was someone who would tell the people, you need to do this, and you need to stop doing this. The prophets also served as foretellers, or forthtellers. They were predicting at times the future. Consider this paraphrase from Acts chapter 15 and verse 18. We'll also include 17, but I think 18 is the key point. God said it, and now he's doing it. It's no afterthought. He's always known he would do it, or he would do this. The text says that God has had plans. Those plans have been eternal plans. God says sometimes he has revealed, he's made known those plans to us, and then he's carried out his plans. One of the great proofs for God's existence, sometimes people will say, why do you believe in God? Well, that's a fair question, that's a good question, and that's a question that we can answer. Or a person might say, I know that you believe in God, why do you believe that the Bible is his word? One of the answers for both questions is predictive prophecy. When we think about this, we're talking about predictions often made hundreds, if not thousands of years in advance, and they are right 100% of the time. We simply have nothing like that in life. Man, whatever field, whatever area we look at, man is impossible. Man simply cannot do that. That is impossible for him. All kinds of people have tried in all kinds of fields, and we can't predict with 100% accuracy what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes, let alone the next 500 years. Before we get to the New Testament, we find some very important rules about predictions or prophecies. Back in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 18 and verse 22, God said, when a prophet, that would be someone who had this ability to predict what was going to take place in the future, when a prophet speaks in the name of Jehovah, if the thing follows not, that is, if this prediction doesn't come to pass, that is, the thing which Jehovah hath not spoken, the prophet that has spoken it presumptuously, thou shalt not be afraid of him. God said, look, back when Moses was on the earth, when he was leading God's people, they knew that there would be people who would make some predictions. God said, if someone makes a prediction, and by chance suppose that prediction is supposedly made by my power, God says the person will say, the God that we serve has given me this information about the future, and God says, if there's ever a time, if there's ever a case where that prediction is not fulfilled, and the implication is it is not fulfilled perfectly, if it's not fulfilled 100%, God said, you reject that guy. That guy is a liar. That guy is not speaking for me. If a money manager were right 50% of the time, people would flock to him. If somebody had that kind of track record, people would make money. They would make a lot of money, and they would say, we want to be your client. Imagine, though, that it wasn't 50% of the time. Imagine there were an investment firm, and they were known for being right 75% of the time. Everybody in that community, probably everybody in the nation, and several people from around the world would want to be tied in with that firm. If there was a money manager that was right 90% of the time, every single client that person had would be filthy rich. You could afford to lose 10% if you had somebody that was right 90% of the time. Imagine, though, a money manager who is right 100% of the time. Every single cent that you invest with that person is always going to work out just like the person believes. Imagine having a money manager who says, I can invest your money with 100% certainty for 100 years. I can do it for 500 years. I can take any amount and I can be on the mark for the next 10,000 years. Well, you think such a person was a liar or an idiot. There's no way somebody can do that. We have no idea what the market's going to do tomorrow, let alone 5 years or 500 years. In fact, in 500 years, 1,000 years, there may not be, or 10,000 years, there may not even be a stock market. The God of the Bible, when it comes to predictive prophecy, this is like child's play to him. Sometimes illustrations, when we talk about this type of attribute or this characteristic from God, illustrations are helpful, and the Bible thankfully gives us that back in the book of Isaiah. You can find a lot of information in Isaiah about the nation of Assyria. We're going to be pulling from about Isaiah chapter 36 and verse 1 up through some information in Isaiah chapter 37. Long ago, there was a king in Assyria by the name of Sennacherib. Sennacherib was not a very nice guy. The Assyrians were not very nice people. Sennacherib, over there in Assyria, was looking at southern Israel. And this king decided on various occasions that he wanted to attack southern Israel. This king believed that his army was invincible. His attitude was, the Hebrew people, they have their God. Other people in this area that we've attacked, they've also had their gods. But the other gods have not been able to repel me and my army. We've overcome all those other gods. And when we go against the Hebrews down there in the southern section of Israel, their God is going to fall like any other god. We've wiped out everybody else. We're coming for them, and we're going to take them out too. The people of God are not going to be any different. When you look at the book of Isaiah, you find that the pride of the Assyrians is noted, and this arrogance that they had, it really cost him. In places like Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 15, you see Here it's couched in figurative language, but you can see how God reproves or rebukes the Assyrians. Shall the axe boast against him who chops with it? The axe, of course, being a reference to the Assyrians. Or shall the saw, again a reference to the Assyrians, or shall the saw exalt itself against him who saws with it? Well, the person who saws and the person who chops, that of course would be God. As if a rod could wield itself against those who lift it up, or as if a staff could lift it up as if it were not wood. God comes back to the Assyrians time and time again and says, you folks are riding high. You think that you're God. You think that you have control of the things. You think that you can overthrow me. I'm going to show you who's boss. In Isaiah chapter 36, verses 1 through 3, this kind of sets the stage. King Hezekiah. And he was, for the most part, a pretty good king. King Hezekiah has been reigning in the southern section of Israel for 14 years. 14 years, quite a while, more than a dozen years. One day the Assyrian army shows up. And Hezekiah, as king, as ruler, as leader, he knows that the Assyrian army is a significant threat. Now, sometimes as nations consider problems, perhaps as they're on the brink of war, a negotiator begins to step in. It might be a high-level diplomat. As you look at what's unfolding in Isaiah chapter 36, you find that there is a spokesman for Assyria. And this fellow is kind of a silver-tongued orator. He goes and he begins to talk to the people of Israel, and he begins to make what sounds like a pretty reasonable appeal. He's a smooth talker, and he begins with, don't look to Egypt. Now, you've got a threat here in your backyard. We can come, we can wipe you out, but it doesn't have to go that way. But you might be thinking, as far as your options, we'll just reach down into Egypt and we'll get some military help there. And this smooth talker, this silver-tongued orator, says, you don't want to do that. He said, think about the history. Egypt has always let people down. They're not going to bail you out in this situation. Don't look to them for assistance. And then he says this, Isaiah chapter 36 and verse 10. He says, your God talked to us. And your God said to us, you go and attack the people of Israel. Now, if your God told us to come and attack you, do you think you're going to win? Well, that might have persuaded at least some of the people. And as this fellow continues his presentation, he tells the people of Israel that they're going to get creamed. They're going to get wiped out. It is not going to go well for them. And then, of course, you would expect that there is some talk of surrender. And this fellow says, if you just surrender, everything's going to be fine. Be taken care of. Everything will be good. Nobody's going to get hurt. You're going to be greatly blessed. And then, if that's not enough, he says, let me tell you about your king. Let me tell you about your leader. He's lying to you. He's not telling the truth. We are the good guys. And we want to be merciful. We want to be kind. We want to be good to you. And that liar that you have for your head, he's not going to be able to protect you. Then we get to the opening verses in Isaiah chapter 37. And here is where we have a kingdom in crisis. Before we get there, let's pick up this from Isaiah chapter 37, verses 6 and 7. Tell your master this, God's message. Don't be upset by what you've heard. All the words the servants of the Syrian king have used to mock me. That's God talking about this fella who was the great spokesman. And he was the silver-tongued orator. God says in verse 7, I personally will take care of him, talking about Sennacherib, the king of Assyria. I'll arrange it so that he'll get a rumor of bad news back home. He's going to rush home to take care of it, and he's going to die there. He's going to be killed. It is going to be a violent death. Things are not looking good. But God, Isaiah is summoned, and God, through this prophet, says things are going to work out. Things are not going to be a problem. God is going to take care of the matter 100%. That was predictive prophecy. Isaiah described what was going to take place. He said that that was going to occur soon. He said that this king was going to die, and he said that this king was going to die a violent death. It was specific prediction, specific prediction, specific prediction, and specific prediction. Assyria had been digging its grave for a long time. And here's a sample of how the Assyrians saw themselves. Again, a paraphrase to make the point. I dug wells and drank my fill. I emptied the famous rivers of Egypt. How'd you do it? With one kick of my foot. Now, can you imagine somebody making that brag or that boast? That's how arrogant these people were. They thought that they could go against any nation, that they could wipe them off. There was not going to be any god anywhere in the planet that could withstand them and their army. Well, God, as he talks about this nation, he doesn't give some kind of vague, obscure, or confusing prophecy. God lays out for his people who needed encouragement what he was going to do. He laid it out step by step as far as what was and what was not going to happen. What God described with specific predictive prophecy was precisely what occurred. God had that foreknowledge, and on this occasion, he let people in on what was going to occur. If we were just told that God has foreknowledge, we can kind of understand that, but there are attributes of God where it's helpful to actually see how that attribute, how that characteristic is used in life. And that's exactly what we find here. We find that in this particular case, what God promised occurred. Isaiah chapter 37, verses 33 and 34. Finally, this is God's verdict on the king of Assyria. That, of course, would be Sennacherib. Don't worry. God says, number one, he's not going to come into the city. It might look like it. It might seem like you're going to be overrun. It might seem like everybody's going to be killed, but don't sweat it. He is not going to set foot in the city. He's not even going to shoot a single arrow. Can you imagine the specificity of that prophecy? God says he's got all these warriors, tens of thousands, more than 100,000 warriors that we'll see in just a minute. And God says there is not, of the nearly 200,000 warriors, there's not going to be a single one that takes out a bow and shoots an arrow. And he's not even going to brandish a shield. It just looks like it's a great threat. And they're not going to build a siege ramp. God said instead of doing what they would normally do, here's a prediction. He's going to go back. And he's not just going to go back, he's going to go back the way he came. He's not going to set a foot in the city. This is my decree. Then a little more. Verses 36 to 38. Then the angel of God, that it would be a reference to Christ in the Old Testament, arrived and struck the Assyrian camp. 185,000 Assyrians died. Who would have predicted that? The mighty Assyrian army? 185,000 people dead? All at once? Strange, odd, but it lines up perfectly with what God said. By the time the sun came up, they were all dead. It was an army of corpses. Sennacherib, king of Assyria, got out of there fast and headed back home to Nineveh. Now, this is just one illustration. We find, as we look elsewhere in the scriptures, for example, Isaiah chapter 37 and verse 38, down a little further, and he was worshiping in the sanctuary of his God after he gets back home. As we move down a little bit more, and he was murdered by his sons. God said, you're going to die. You're going to die soon. You're going to die a violent death. And that is exactly right. As we look elsewhere, we find even more information pulling now from Jeremiah chapter 28 and verse 15. Then said different set of circumstances. Then said the prophet Jeremiah unto Hananiah the prophet. Hear now, Hananiah. Jehovah has not sent you, but you make this people to trust in a lie. You are doing some bad stuff. You are displeasing God. You need to die. And here is God's message. Here is a prediction. You are going to die. Next verse. Therefore, thus says Jehovah, behold, I will send thee away from off the earth. You're going to disappear from the face of the earth. That means you're going to die. And God says that death is going to occur this year because you have spoken rebellion against Jehovah. And that is precisely what happened. Looking down now, one more verse. In verse 27, or verse 17 of Jeremiah 28, so Hananiah the prophet died the same year in the seventh month. God has no difficulty whatsoever predicting future events. And thankfully, sometimes God has let us have some insight as far as his predictions, and he's never been wrong. Now, if God has this ability, and God shows us this ability, I would begin to wonder if we can find this ability scattered not only perhaps in the prophets, but if we can locate this event and tie it in with special times in human history. For example, Jesus, when it was time for him to come into the world, would we find some information in scripture concerning predictive prophecy and applying that to Christ? That would seem to be the perfect tool to bring Jesus or help bring Jesus into the world. Well, we do find that. Not only do we find predictive prophecy when it comes to specific and special events associated with the Bible, we find that those predictions are made very, very early. Do you remember Noah? Do you recall how many sons he had? How many? Three, right? All right. The plan was, God's plan was to bring the Messiah into the world through one of those three sons. Now, how would you like to put on your guessing hat and say, okay, we've got three boys to choose from. Which son is it going to be? Is it going to be this one? Is it going to be this one? Is it going to be this one? Would you feel lucky? Would you be willing to guess? Well, guess what God did? Shem. God says, we've got three to pick from here, and God says the Messiah is going to come through Shem. Genesis chapter 9 and verse 26, Luke chapter 3 and verse 36. Imagine predicting the coming of the most important person in the world. You've got three families to choose from, and you say, this one is going to be the lineage. And you're making that prediction thousands of years in advance. You eliminate, you fully eliminate two families. It's not, well, I think it's going to be this one, or more than likely it's going to be this one, or we probably don't want to emphasize these two because this one is the most probable one. There was none of that. It's going to be Shem, 100% guaranteed. And that's what happened. All right, after making that clear, the Bible gets, once again, quite specific. The promised one was going to come through the line of Abraham. And that was fulfilled, Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Now, as you think about Abraham, do you remember some children in his family? We, of course, have the sons, Isaac and Ishmael. You remember of those two, which one was chosen? Isaac. You know, God said it's going to come through Isaac. And as you look at the line of the genealogy, that was true, that prediction. Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Thinking about Isaac, what about his family? Well, we've got two sons, Jacob and Esau. Jacob was the predicted one, and once again, that prediction came true. 100% true, Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Jacob, you may remember him and his family. Jacob's got 12 sons. How would you like to, when you look at the 12 tribes of Israel, say we've got 12 boys, we've been right as far as our predictions, we got the three families, choosing the right person there, choosing the line of Shem, and then we made another right prediction, we made another right prediction, but now we've got 12 befores, and we're going to have to choose the right son out of the 12. Would you want to keep on your guessing hat and say, okay, it's going to be this one and not this one? Would you have chosen Judah if you were back there making the predictions? Well, that prediction was made thousands of years in advance. The line, the Messiah, is going to come through Judah. And that's exactly what happened. As the Old Testament continues, more predictions pop up. The Messiah was going to come through the family of Jesse. And guess what? That was also the case. It was going to be the household of David. Now, Jesse, let's set aside Joseph for just a little bit and the tribe of Judah, the 12 sons, and let's think for just a second about Jesse. Do you remember how many boys he had? Eight, right? Eight sons. How would you like to be the prophet who's out there and you're looking at all eight boys? Would you like to guess which one it was going to be? I'll tell you, had I been the guesser on that occasion, I would have got it wrong. I would have been just like the guy who was sent there to anoint David, and I would have been completely wrong and said, this is my guess, this is my prediction. Wrong, old Brad. Well, let me get another guess. And after I got through all seven, well, I guess I got it right now. Just like the weatherman. We've been wrong for a week, but now we finally can give you the correct information. We are bad guessers oftentimes. Then as we start looking at Jesus' prediction elsewhere in the Bible, we find that there were some other predictions. For example, Micah chapter 5 and verse 2, the place. Can you imagine all the cities, all the towns, all the areas in the area of Israel? And God says, I'm going to tell you where the Messiah is going to come from. It's going to be Bethlehem. Micah chapter 5 and verse 2. Had that been me, I would have said, oh, it's got to be Jerusalem. I mean, that's the obvious place. That's the clear choice. That would have been wrong. Then we've got information about Jesus' burial, his betrayal, his death, the 30 pieces of silver. His resurrection was predicted. We've got information as far as the destruction of Jerusalem. That was predicted. How are you going to predict the overthrow, the complete overthrow, within a certain period of time, within the first century? That's exactly what Jesus did. Predictive prophecy, and there is so much of that in Scripture. It is one of the greatest tools that we have to prove two things. If you ever in your Christian life begin to have some doubts about God, can I really know that God is out there? Is my faith something that really needs to continue because I'm just at a point in life where I'm not sure that God exists? Look to predictive prophecy. There is no way at all, that when you start looking, and there are literally hundreds of them, if you just limit that even to a study of Christ's life, there's no way at all that people could have predicted those kinds of things hundreds of years in advance. There is a God, and that God is the God of the Bible. He's all the things that we read about in Scripture and so much more. He's capable of predictive prophecy. He's proven that hundreds and hundreds of times, and he wants to save us. He wants us to be with him forever. What an incredible offer. And what a foolish choice to say no to that offer for whatever reason. Whether it's the things of this life or we think he's asking too much out of us, whatever it is. God says, I want you and I want you to know me. Do you know it? Are you one of his people? Hopefully you are. And if you're not, tonight, hopefully you make that decision to be one of his children. Faith, repentance, confession, baptism, faithful Christian living. It is that simple. It is that easy. And we can respond now and do what's required as we stand and sing.